Today on Straight Talk Africa, behind the scenes of Boko Haram, secret videos reveal the faces of terrorists committing atrocities and uncover a power struggle among Boko Haram leaders. VOA's exclusive investigative series, Boko Haram Terror Unmasked. That's coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America studios here in Washington. I am Shaka Sali.
And hello to all our viewers and listeners on the continent and elsewhere. I'm Ayan Bior, your social media reporter.
Today, we present excerpts from the powerful VOA series Boko Haram, Terror Unmasked. Through secret videos obtained by VOA, we see through the terrorist lens what it is like inside one of the world's deadliest extremist groups.
And coming up later in our STA inbox, our audience has weighed in on our topic through emails and Facebook comments, and we'll reveal some of them ahead on Straight Talk Africa.
Boko Haram militants continue to commit atrocities against Nigerian civilians. Now VOA brings you a behind-the-scenes look at this terrorist group, drawing on 18 hours of raw video recorded by Boko Haram themselves and obtained by VOA. Our journalists spent months reviewing and translating the videos and traveling to northeast Nigeria to provide additional in-depth reporting. Viewer discretion is advised.
Kunshe, Borno State, Nigeria. In the dusty square of this small village, morning awakens. One of the world's deadliest terror groups prepares a lesson in fear and death. This video has never been seen in public. It shows villagers rounded up and forced to witness beatings and executions by armed members of Boko Haram, all in the name of its distorted version of Islam. It comes from 18 hours of secret videos created by Boko Haram and obtained by VOA that document the group's brutal insurgency. Over 7 years, more than 18,000 people have died in Boko Haram violence in Nigeria and its neighbors, many in tribunals like this one. The tribunal is a tool, a ritual of control everyone is forced to watch. A judge leans down, asking three men if they accept Boko Haram's finding of guilt for drug dealing and a penalty of death. Others charged with using drugs will be killed too if it happens again, the judge says. For now, they will be beaten. The beatings continue more than 30 minutes. Then the men move aside until only the condemned remain. The Boko Haram emir binds the hands of Gambo Abba, lying on the ground. He points his index fingers at the sky and prays, a final gesture that many Muslims believe will open the gates to heaven.
Allahu Akbar!
As the final prisoner lays on the ground, a third executioner approaches, firing two shots. Behind the bodies, Boko Haram members drop to their knees and kiss the ground. After 7 years of fighting, about 2 million Nigerians remain displaced from their homes. In Borno State, half a million live in camps without sufficient food, water, and medical attention. The scars from Boko Haram will not go away anytime soon. This video, recorded by Boko Haram but never publicly aired, was obtained exclusively by VOA. It provides an unprecedented look inside a Boko Haram assault and the deadly consequences for Nigerians who crossed their path. Based on satellite images, VOA believes the attack took place at the town of Banki in an area where Boko Haram operated in late 2014 and 2015. Before the battle, fighters assemble, rifles and RPGs at hand. Many are young men conscripted from their villages to join Boko Haram, some barely in their teens. Commanders address them in Arabic and the local Kanuri language, preparing them to kill and to be killed. Leading the attack are four commanders dispatched from Boko Haram's high command. The Boko Haram videographer records from behind the front line. There is shooting, then confusion. The shooting continues to dusk, then subsides. Some attackers wander off. For years, Boko Haram fighters overran poorly equipped Nigerian garrisons. But these troops prove up to the fight. Boko Haram casualties mount, and the barracks' defenses appear to hold. Boko Haram's campaign of violence has shattered lives, displaced millions, and destroyed the social order in northeastern Nigeria. How is Islam twisted to justify such suffering?
Now joining us here in our Washington studios are two distinguished guests. Ibrahim Ahmed, Managing Editor, Digital Media, VOA House Service, and Helen Habila, a Nigerian award-winning author of several books, including The Chibok Girls, The Boko Haram Kidnapping and Islamist Militancy in Nigeria. Is currently a professor of creative writing at the George Mason University in Virginia here in the United States. Well, gentlemen, I honestly have to say that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the two of you for the first time on Straight Talk Africa.
It's a pleasure. Shaka.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. You're most welcome.
Yes.
Later in the program, we'll give you, the audience, a chance to call and talk with our guests. The number to call is 202-619-3111. U.S. country code is 1. Let me come to you immediately, Ibrahim. What was it like, really, for you when you first began watching some of these footages that we just watched?
It was really amazing because when VOA got these videos, we had no idea what was in it. We were not told what was in it. We were just called and asked to come and watch something and give our view on what we are watching. So we just sat down and started watching these videos. Most of it is extremely hard to watch because of the violence, the extreme violence in those videos. But it immediately became clear that what we were watching was something from Boko Haram. It was something that Boko Haram shot themselves. And we realized that it was something that they shot just for their own use, not something that they had wanted the public to see. Because when Boko Haram does something or stage something for the public, most of the time, they have their faces covered. And the only people you see openly are their leaders. Nobody knows, the facial features of Boko Haram leaders or members, except for Abubakar Shekau, Manchari, Mamanur, those three, maybe four of them. But in these videos, we see these people openly, the commanders, the leaders, the imams, the fighters, the members, in their what you can call natural environment, sitting and talking to each other, meeting, eating food, playing with each other, stuff that they do normally that are not staged for public consumption.
What about you as a Nigerian, and in fact as a Nigerian who happens to come from the northern part of the country, where what we just see, what we just saw is in fact happening, except that of course it is happening in the northeastern part of the country?
It was also very difficult. We have seen stuff that Boko Haram has done. We have heard what Boko Haram was capable of doing. We have heard that in 2014, Boko Haram was the most deadliest terror group in the world, more than ISIS, more than Al-Qaeda, more than Al-Shabaab. But we have never seen the raw violence that Boko Haram exhibited until we saw those footage. And it was incredibly violent.
Helon, what about you, my brother? You happen to come from the specific areas, in fact, which happens to be the theater, frankly, of operations of Boko Haram. You also have written a book about that particular, tragedy to boot.
Yes. Like my fellow guest here said, it's just hard to be from there and to see these footages, you know, and to know the whole history of Boko Haram, what they have done, you know, since, say, 2009, when their leader was killed, and 2010, when they really emerged as a fighting unit and started attacking people and indiscriminately women, and then, of course, ultimately kidnapping the Chibok girls. So it's always heartbreaking to know this thing has been going on. Government has tried to stop it, sometimes unsuccessfully. Recently, of course, they have made a lot of progress. I think the only hope one can, you know, say, one can express is that the government is going to keep pushing them back and try to regain as much territory and to release as many people as they can. So we can only have hope, I think, going forward.
Is it true, for example, that the government is currently in charge or in control, has in fact secured Sambisa Forest, which used to be the epicenter of Boko Haram?
Yeah, the so-called Camp Zero. Of course, we've all read about it. You know, we've seen the footage of President Buhari being presented with the flag that was purportedly, you know, captured from that Camp Zero. Mm-hmm. But the question that's being begged here is, where is Shekau? Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. Where are the commanders? Uh-huh. Where are the Chibok girls? Uh-huh. If this was the ultimate, you know, camp for these people, where are they? So there is a lot to be done, you know, in this fight.
But talking about where is Abubakar Shekau, I gather from a bit of my research that he may in fact have been replaced sometime last year by someone called Abu Musab El-Bamwa?
Al-Barnawi, but replaced doesn't mean that he's been taken out.
But is he in fact alive? Because there were reports some time back which suggested that in fact he may have been killed.
From all we know, Abubakar Shekau is still alive and he is still leading Boko Haram. In 2015, Boko Haram pledged allegiance to ISIS. But later on, ISIS, some months later, declared that the new leader of their West Africa province is Abu Musab al-Barnawi, who happens to be the son of the late founder of Boko Haram. Mm-hmm. Abubakar Shekau, quickly, the next day, he came out with a statement saying that he's still the leader of Boko Haram. And he went back to calling Boko Haram by its original name before they joined ISIS, Jamaat Ali Sunnat al-Dawah wal-Jihad. We went back to calling this, which means, you know, there's a friction.
So there is probably an apparent split.
There is a split in Boko Haram. And from the raw videos, we saw the Boko Haram footage. Mm-hmm. We saw evidence of that split even before ISIS announced that it appointed al-Barnawi as the leader, because that was apparently in one of the videos, somebody who said he was a messenger from Abu Bakr Shekau, and he stood up in front of everybody, the commanders, the leaders, the imams, and everybody, and he was talking about some people he described as hypocrites among them. Mm. And he specifically mentioned names of people that he said they shouldn't listen to because they are preaching something against the leadership of Boko Haram.
Interesting, Ibrahim. We'll come to that. Yes. Time is not our best ally. Now we'll pause for a short break and would like to remind you the entire four-part series, Boko Haram, Terror and Mask, can be found on voanews.com. Also, Straight Talk Africa is now streaming live on Facebook. Just enter the keyword Straight Talk Africa and watch our show live. Also, don't forget to share it with your friends. Don't forget, we are also on Twitter and we are tweeting live. Follow us at VOA Shaka, that's VOA Shaka, and join in on today's discussion with your questions and comments. Don't forget to use the hashtag VOA Boko Haram. We'll be right back with you, so please, don't go away.
We are able to touch on things that are important to people on an everyday basis. We hope that our viewers are getting inspired when they watch our show. They're getting a view of the world from a different perspective, things that perhaps are not in their immediate vicinity. Today, I could put in on the show something that is a little different, a little unique, and this gives me that inspiration to come to work.
This is Straight Talk Africa on the Voice of America. What is your opinion about today's topic? Call us at 202-619-3111, U.S. country code 1. When you call, remember the following. Ask only one question, keep your comment brief, and turn down the volume on your radio or television. Now let's return to Straight Talk Africa.
Welcome back. Before the break, we saw dramatic footage that not only showed the faces of Boko Haram terrorists, who usually wear masks, but also revealed a power struggle between the group's leaders. Across Nigeria, Boko Haram has left a trail of death and destruction, all in the name of religion. But how can Islam, a peaceful faith, justify such brutality? Let's discuss Boko Haram's extremist origins and why clerics condemn their version of Islam. Let me come to you, Professor Helen. You know,
Northern Nigeria has for centuries been an important crossroads for Islamic thought. Boko Haram's radical roots trace to the preaching of one man, Muhammad Yusuf. In the 1990s, Yusuf broke from an influential mentor in Maiduguri, denouncing Western education and government as un-Islamic. Young, disenfranchised Nigerians, some in criminal gangs, were drawn to his charisma. In 2009, hundreds of Yusuf's followers were killed by police after a spate of violence. Police captured and executed Yusuf in the street outside their headquarters. For a time, his followers melted away, then came back in search of revenge. The group took an official name, People Committed to the Propagation of the Prophet's Teachings and Jihad, or more popularly, Boko Haram, for Western education is forbidden. Years of violence followed. In Mamudo, they burned a high school with students inside. In Madala, they bombed a Catholic church on Christmas Day.
in Kano, a suicide attack killed 120 worshippers praying at a mosque. Then in 2014, an act that brought global condemnation, kidnapping 276 girls from a Chibok school, most of whom remain captive. Shekau, the group's leader, said the girls shouldn't have been in school. God instructed me to sell them. They are his properties and I will carry out his instructions. Ibrahim Muhammad Duguri, a leading scholar of Sunni Islam in Abuja, says such acts are absolutely forbidden. But the Boko Haram videos obtained by VOA show them flogging a boy, executing an old disabled man, and chopping off hands during tribunals, all in the name of Allah. The brutality is so extreme that it has carved a rift even inside Boko Haram. A new faction, led by Mamman Nur, once a deputy of Yusuf, now claims Shekau is too violent. The schism erupted this summer as government troops regained territory from Boko Haram. But nearly 2 million refugees remain, and Boko Haram is still active in rural areas. Abul Fathi said Islam must resolve its internal differences, or groups like Boko Haram will persist. If we don't stop this hate among us, we will be done with Boko Haram, he says. But we will be dealing with another group with a different name.
Professor Habila.
Yes.
We know that Boko Haram started, you know, causing violence and what have you back in 2009. Do we really know what are the fundamental root causes of its existence, really? Because if we did, one would have thought that the authorities and the government, indeed, would have been able to answer that question.
Yes, that's a very good point. I don't think there's one single, cause or inspiration, you know, that brought about the existence of Boko Haram. You have to look at the history of the country itself. You have to look at the state of the Northeast, maybe compared to other parts of the country. The Northeast has always been the most undereducated part of the whole country. Mm-hmm. It's always been one of the most underdeveloped parts of the country in terms of, you know, livelihood. And increasingly, livelihood was declining, the quality of was declining, because one of the sources of job providers in that part of the country has always been the Lake Chad, which was this big internal body of water that people used to use for fishing, for farming, and all that. Now, mm-hmm. that lake has shrunken to about 10% mm-hmm. of its original size. So there's all this outward movement of people coming to Maiduguri and other urban areas. Mm-hmm. And people like that became easy prey, easy followers to people like Muhammad Yusuf mm-hmm. and his preaching. Because when he came out, at first, he was actually trying to take care of people. You know, he was providing microfinancing for people. He was feeding people. You know, he was arranging marriages for people. So there was that welfareist appearance at first, which drew people to him. So there's always that aspect of poverty and failure of government to take care of people and to address people's concerns.
Very interesting.
And that kind of pushed them towards these extremist preachers and people like that.
And let's not forget also, by the way, that Boko Haram also operates in neighboring Chad,
correct.
Niger, and the Cameroon, correct?
Correct, correct.
And could that be perhaps or a result of poverty?
Yes.
A result, perhaps, in fact, of bad governance?
I think so.
Or perhaps because there have not really been some very strong and effective ogres, as you call the big man syndrome, mm-hmm. from that region so that they can deliver some goods.
I think so. You have to when you address the issues, the root causes of Boko Haram, you have to address the failure of democracy in most of West African countries. Mm-hmm. Nigeria being a good example. Mm-hmm. Niger also suffering, you know, from its own lack of democracy and transparency. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, what happens is that the small person is always forgotten. The big person, the ogas, as you call them, they are there and they are living very large.
Yes,
and people get very angry. What do they do? You know, they then are drawn to these factors. Of course, we are not discounting the presence of ideology, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. Of religion itself.
Right.
As we saw in the video, one of the videos you just showed, the rise of Boko Haram also came as a result of kind of disruption within the Muslim community, you know, in that part of the country. Different groups, there was schisms and there was need for reform. Mm. So when people like Mohammed Yusuf came up and tried to condemn other factions of Islam and said that his own faction was the purest and the truest, you know, that also kind of points to that schism within the Muslim community in Nigeria. So there are all these factors that kind of led to the rise. But ultimately, Shekau came with his violent agenda and then distorted the whole movement, and it became just almost like a purely violent organization that attacked the police, attacked schools, tried to destroy totally education and to kind of demoralize the whole region of that country. For what end, one might ask, you know, could be because of his own need for power.
Interesting.
Could be for political purposes, for so many reasons. But this is the ultimate result of that rising, yeah.
Ibrahim, you have obviously covered that story. You've been reporting on it for a very long time. Where do they... I'm talking about Boko Haram. Where do they get these sophisticated weapons, for example? If, in fact, they could access these sophisticated weapons, which cost a lot of money, one would have probably thought that they could have used the same amount of money to provide services, to provide the education, so that they could deal with some of the social issues.
That's a big question. Let me touch on something that Mr. Abila was just talking about. Ideology played a very big role in the rise of Boko Haram, but also the heavy-handedness of authorities played a very big role. Don't forget that the 2009 crisis started with something as simple as the issue of wearing a helmet while riding motorcycles. That's how it started, and you know, some in authority thought they could easily deal with this issue by kind of doing away with the leadership of the group. And then it turned out that the group didn't die. It went into hibernation and it came back, and when it came back very violent. The issue of arms, before 2009, there were stories that Boko Haram was bringing weapons from Algeria. They were getting most of their influence from Algeria, from a group that at one time had won an election in Algeria, but the authorities didn't allow it to progress. So those members of the groups went around the West African sub-region trying to recruit people to their own ideology of Islam. That's how Boko Haram started. There was a story that they were bringing weapons at the time. But don't forget that heavy weapons in the hands of Boko Haram started appearing after the fall of Gaddafi. That was when we had reports that Boko Haram was training with the Islamist militant in Mali.
2011.
Some of them were soldiers for Gaddafi in Libya.
Right.
And when he was killed, all the weapons they had, they moved with them to Mali, and then they moved with them to Nigeria. We started seeing those weapons appearing in Nigeria. Up to the present day, the main sources, according to experts, the main sources for weapons for Boko Haram is from Libya.
But what about reports about perhaps having, in fact, infiltrated the Nigerian army, especially because of apparent corruption in that particular institution?
There were allegations of that, although there is nothing that has been proven conclusively about that. There were instances when Boko Haram attacked some military target, apparently just maybe like a few hours after the garrison received armed supplies. Example, the old multinational headquarters, which was in Baga in Nigeria, you know, they had a supply of weapons, and overnight Boko Haram came, overran the garrison and captured all the arms there, armored tanks, military tanks, weapons, all kind of sophisticated weapons. You know, it happened that. So there were reports, there were allegations that there was corruption that they had infiltrated. But
that is evidence. Yeah. Did. Well, you're tuned into Straight Talk Africa, reminding you that the entire four-part series, Boko Haram, Terror, and Masked, can be found on voanews.com. We'll have more of a discussion in a moment, but first here is Ayen Bior. Take it away, Ayen.
Thanks, Shaka. And still to come, we'll reveal some of the outstanding feedback we've received from our audience through social media. We'll be right back.
Today's youth are not just the next generation of African leaders. They are today's leaders. And this is the time to invest in them. Today, not tomorrow. So let's connect. Let's engage with each other on issues that will transform our societies.
Innovation, leadership, entrepreneurship, things that you're doing to move the continent forward to make you the greatest generation that Africa has known.
It's Upfront every Wednesday, 1730 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
This is Straight Talk Africa on The Voice of America. Call us now with your questions and comments. The number is 202-619-3111 and the U.S. country code is 1. Call us direct and we'll call you right back. Remember to turn down the volume on your radio or television and keep your comments brief. Now back to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Esther Githiu-Ewart, and welcome back to Straight Talk Africa, live from Washington. Once again, it's time to bring in my colleague and social media reporter, Ayen. Take it away again, Ayen.
Well, thanks again, Shaka. We received excellent feedback in our STA inbox to this week's question of the week on the northern Nigeria-based terrorist group Boko Haram. The militant group has targeted both Muslims and Christians, killing more than 20,000 people since 2009. Our question of the week asks, what do you think should be done to stop the Boko Haram acts of terror? Well, starting off the conversation is Christopher from Tanzania with our letter of the week.
Our letter of the week is from Christopher Mwakaji from Tanzania, who writes, social injustice is a major cause of not only Boko Haram, but most of the terrorist groups that we are aware of. Until society and political authorities start paying attention to the needs of the people, especially the poor and destitute, I don't see an end to terrorism. It's high time for authorities to start focusing on improving universal and affordable medical care, transportation, education, and housing. That is one way of curbing this disease of terrorism that seems to be provoked by the increase of social injustice and lack of concern to the poor.
Thank you again, Christopher, for sharing your thoughts with us. And before we continue, I'd like to thank our viewers and listeners for using our social media platforms to communicate with us. And another reminder that we are tweeting live today, so you can follow this conversation in real time with the hashtag VOA Boko Haram. And if you haven't yet, please follow us at VOA Shaka. And speaking of tweets, let's go to one from Prince Habat Nkula, who writes, talking to them and finding a way to end the rebel attacks is arrived to amicably. We have another tweet from Upano Godfrey, who says, war alone cannot solve a problem. Let Boko Haram also be engaged in peace talks if they can. War should be a last resort. And our last tweet is from Nasoro Katunda. He says, we need to think of ways to provide rights and justice in our community in all spheres. Now to a comment from Facebook fan Ampofo Obagye from Ghana, who writes, I believe that the people in the areas that Boko Haram normally hides in must be fully informed on the reason why education is much better than guns. I believe that the Nigerian government must build a strong security hub to locate and destabilize their work. Well, Shaka, as you can see, there is certainly no shortage of opinions here. Your thoughts?
Very interesting. What about you, Professor Habila? It looks like the watchword here really is the need for socio-economic justice.
Yes. When you ask the question, you know, how can we defeat, or how can Nigerian government defeat Boko Haram, I think there are two approaches. The first, of course, is the military approach to try to degrade Boko Haram as much as possible because the government is engaged in this war. So Boko Haram is engaged in the government and government must respond.
Which the military under General Buhari seems to be doing, actually.
Exactly. The first thing he did when he came into power was to move the operations headquarters to Maiduguri.
Right.
And that kind of yielded immediate results. The caliphate, the so-called caliphate, was immediately disbanded, which used to have its headquarters in Gosa. So that took away the caliphate from Boko Haram, so they couldn't boast of that.
Mm-hmm.
And they were pushed more and more, you know, to the fringes. So that was the first part, fight them militarily.
Mm-hmm.
And the second part would be the long-term approach. And I think he was also wise, that's the president, when he first came and began to build partnerships with different countries. He came to America, if you remember. He
Correct.
Went to Britain and started soliciting for support because Nigeria cannot fight Boko Haram alone. So there has to be cooperation with all these foreign partners, which I think Jonathan failed to do at that time. And you have to find a way of getting this government to sell arms to the Nigerian military, which was really very short on arms. And even Boko Haram was more prepared in terms of, you know, weaponry than the Nigerian government. The long-term approach, again, is how do you resuscitate this region that's literally dying in terms of education, in terms of employment, poverty, and so many things? Right now, there are about 2 million people, getting to 3 million people displaced by Boko Haram.
Right.
They're in camps. And according to the UN, almost 100,000 people are facing starvation in the northeastern region right now as we speak. So these are things, these are the long-term, you know, issues that the government has to deal with. And they can only do that by forming partnerships with international organizations and really trying to get to the root causes of what kind of brought Boko Haram into existence in the first place.
Any more social media reaction from around the globe? Ian?
Yes, in fact, let's go to another comment from a Facebook fan, Aluka Jeffrey Amusia, who writes, "I don't think you can solve the problem of Boko Haram and terrorism without understanding its root causes. What Nigeria is doing is cutting the stems and not killing the root. Both sides need to engage in meaningful peace negotiations." And our last Facebook comment comes from Kansime Greens in Uganda, who has a difference of opinion. He says, "I don't see any logic in having political dialogue with terrorists like Boko Haram. ECOWAS should look at these terrorists as a regional threat and not just a Nigerian political threat." Well, Shaka, both of these comments were certainly echoed multiple times on social media. Your thoughts?
Interesting. Ibrahim, your reaction?
I think you can only talk to somebody who wants to talk to you.
That is a dialogue.
The dialogue.
Not a monologue.
Not a monologue, exactly. Yeah, because the Jonathan government has tried to talk with Boko Haram.
Tried, you mean?
Yes, in the past, and it didn't get to anything. The Buhari administration also at some point had tried to talk to Boko Haram, but it seems like those factions that are engaging in the talk seems to be like some, probably they don't have influence within the organization, because every time they talk about achieving something, the Shekau faction will come out and say, "We are not engaging any talk with the government. We are not going to talk with this government because we don't recognize this government at all." So it's difficult to talk to the people that do not want to talk to you. It is possible to talk to other factions like Maman Nur, because it's somebody who appeared like willing to talk about the issues. But does he have the influence? Does he carry any weight within the organization to end this? That's the big question.
But when you go back to the time when Goodluck Jonathan was the man in charge of ASOROC in Abuja, mm-hmm. you are talking about Boko Haram in control of an area that is almost the size of the Republic of Rwanda.
That is true.
So, frankly, where would be the incentive here for them to talk?
Maybe there was no incentive at the time, but now, if you talk about now, you know, the government is really fighting Boko Haram and is having a very big success. We have seen it. Yeah. Talking about Sambisa, they said they have taken them out of Sambisa, Camp Zero in Sambisa, but don't forget that Camp Zero is only one of the camps in Sambisa Forest. Mm. Sambisa Forest is about 60,000 square kilometers. There are hundreds of camps in there. There are hiding places in there. Just last week, Boko Haram militants came out and attacked a military convoy escorting traders and civilians from Maiduguri to Dambua. They came out of the Sambisa Forest. And when they attacked them, they went back into the Sambisa Forest. So the Chief of Army Staff, General Burate, who I will say has been really great in fighting Boko Haram, you know, he came out last week to say that, look, Sambisa Forest, you know, is huge. You know, we have dislodged them from where we believed they had their major camp. And they are gone from there. They have been in that camp since 2013, Camp Zero. And don't forget, Camp Zero is only maybe about 10, 15 kilometers from Bama. And Bama had been in the hands of the military since 2015.
Interesting.
Yes.
Well, thanks again for bringing us this week's audience reaction.
Well, that does it for today's social media segment. Just a reminder that we appreciate your feedback, whether it's in social media form or using other means to communicate with us. Please keep them coming. And if you're a new fan, drop us a line at africatv@voanews.com. Once again, our email address is africatv@voanews.com. Or post your comment on our Facebook page. Enter the keyword Straight Talk Africa. Be sure to visit us online at voaafrica.com, or you can join our YouTube channel. Sign up to VOA TV to Africa. And follow us on Twitter at VOA Shaka. A reminder that the show is streaming live every Wednesday. Go to VOA Straight Talk Africa TV program page on our website. Or simply watch us live on your mobile device. Just download the VOA mobile app. Now let's take a look at what's on tap for next week's program.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the book The Audacity to Change, Breaking the Berlin Wall in Africa, written by Professor Michael D. Kaluuya. He's a consultant at the Center for Public Policy and Global Business Initiatives. That's right here on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Welcome back to our discussion on Boko Haram. We have seen video from inside their operations in northern Nigeria, and we have taken a look at why Islamic clerics condemn the terrorist group's version of Islam. But what next? Is there an end in sight? And how will Nigerians overcome the massive humanitarian and security challenges ahead? Well, with us today is Ibrahim Ahmed, Managing Editor of Digital Media with VOA's Hausa Service, and Heron Habila, a Nigerian award-winning author of several books, including The Chibok Girls, The Boko Haram Kidnappings, and Islamist Militancy in Nigeria. He's currently a professor of creative writing at George Mason University here in the United States. Gentlemen, again, I have to say that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the two of you for the first time on Straight Talk Africa.
It's our pleasure.
You're most welcome. Professor, you wanted to say something, I thought, but unfortunately, there happens not to be democracy in Studio 52, because when you are told to go, you have to go.
You have to go.
Yes. So for that, I think I owe you an apology, really. I hope that you can find some beautiful space in your Nigerian heart. Forgive me for that. Say what you wanted to say, please?
We were talking about dialogue, and monologue and things like that.
Yeah.
And I think one of the signs of dialogue that we've seen recently And I think it's a sign of weakness on Boko Haram, because initially, why they didn't have dialogue with the government is they didn't even recognize the government.
No,
yeah. As far as they're concerned, they didn't recognize the government, they didn't recognize the Nigerian state. So after the split between the two groups, with Barnawi and Shekau, this was the first time we saw Shekau, I think, negotiating when we had the release of the 21 girls.
Correct.
This was a negotiated release.
Correct.
Even though the Nigerian government said that it didn't enter into dialogue with Boko Haram, because most governments wouldn't want to be seen to be negotiating with terrorists. But it did happen that there was a discussion with Boko Haram,
yes,
and they released 21 girls. So this, I think, is a very good sign that they are beginning to be willing to talk to the government and to begin to release the girls. It's a sign of weakness on their part.
That
now
true.
They feel pressed. They feel that they have to give something. So I think going forward, that should be continued.
What about on the side of the government itself? It is obviously, it has been able to use the stick rather, very effectively. Don't you think that perhaps it is also time for it now to bring about the carrot?
I think so. And that has been one of the failures of the Nigerian government. Traditionally, the Nigerian military has always been heavy-handed when they deal with civilians. If you remember, in 2011, when Boko Haram started emerging, the civilians were actually more afraid of the military than the Boko Haram.
Correct.
They were just killing people on the streets in Maiduguri, pushing people into the arms of Boko Haram.
Yeah.
Most people joined Boko Haram because of the heavy-handedness of the Nigerian military.
Yeah.
So going forward, the military has to find a way of engaging. You know, they have to change their approach, show that we're here to win the hearts of the people, to work with the people.
Right.
And they did start to do that when they begin to enlist the help of the civilian JTF. And that was the first time that we started to see significant progress being made in the war against Boko Haram, when they started using civilians, talking to civilians, listening to civilians. So I think there should be, that lesson should have been learned by the military by now.
Yeah. Ibrahim, what have you really learned when you think about what you have viewed, what you have accessed, what you have had? What have you learned that you were not aware of so far?
Well, I will say that despite the story that Boko Haram has been done for, they are still almost everywhere in the Northeast. You know, you don't see them in the towns, you don't see them in the cities where they used to occupy, but they are still in the rural areas, and they are still a threat to people in those areas. That's one thing you learn. But also the fact that the devastation, the humanitarian situation is so bad, because almost every place that Boko Haram has ruled before is completely destroyed. Take, for example, the cities like Bama, like Damasak, like Goza, Pulka, Banki, all those areas. You know, if you go, the structures, the infrastructure has been completely destroyed. The schools, the health clinic, civilian houses, everything has been destroyed and burnt. That's what you come up with. That is so scary. That makes you think that, is it possible? How possible is it for the government to rebuild and for people to rebuild their lives after this terrible thing?
Now, Professor, there are people who will tell you that, look, wait a minute, you can't quite possibly have a group of people, no matter how violent they may be, without, in fact, having support around where they may be operating. There is a saying, of course, that one man is a terrorist may, in fact, be another man is a freedom fighter. How do the ordinary people in that area look at Boko Haram?
You see, most of the Boko Haram's fighters are conscripted, soldiers, little kids that they conscript by force to join them. So most of them didn't have a choice. They were not given choice whether to join or not.
From the beginning?
Well, From the beginning, when they started to, you know, to overtake villages, mm-hmm. you know,
mm-hmm. basically, when they started capturing towns and villages.
Yeah. 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 So where would these people go? There isn't a palpable presence of government there. The police cannot protect them. The military cannot protect them. Boko Haram is the only force, you know, that can protect them. So they started following Boko Haram. So most of these people had no choice in the first place. Mm. So they come there, they establish their government. You know, they subdue the women. They kill some of the men who reject them, who don't want to follow them.
Right.
So basically, you either follow them or you die. And as he said, Boko Haram doesn't seem to have a plan for governing these areas. They just go there, they spread terror, they kill people, they take their farm products and all that. They didn't build institutions. They didn't build schools to educate the people in their ideology. So Shekau didn't seem to have a plan. I think that's one of the ultimate things that's going to lead to their downfall, because they don't have a plan going forward. They just spread terror mm-hmm. and to intimidate people and demoralize people. And that cannot, you know, sustain any kind of movement in the long run.
Interesting. Let's go to the lifeline for the show, which are the telephone callers. Good evening, Patrick from Nigeria. You're most welcome to Straight Talk Africa.
Shaka, good evening, our guest.
You're terrific. How are you?
Mm-hmm. I'm fine, sir. So, Patrick Okafor here in Arjuku, Nigeria. I want to find out from the prof, sir. Looking at the situation on the ground, you see that some of these things, as you rightly said, these are the result of political talks that we're having all this. Now, prof, a situation whereby, like what we see on the paper today, where an underage child was given 200 naira to go and bomb a motor park. Now, Prof, what advice will you give we parents? Looking at the scenario, what is happening now, a child of less than 15 years given 200 naira, are we saying that the parents have failed to do their responsibility, or the society have failed, or the parents don't want to see what's going on? Because as a parent, you should know the whereabouts of your child at a particular moment. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Patrick. Let me go to Ghana before I come to you, Professor. Good evening, Tafa from Ghana. You're most welcome to Straight Talk Africa.
Hello, good evening, Shaka.
You're really terrific. How are you today?
Well, I'm great, Shaka.
What's your question, sir?
Shaka, my question to our guest is that sometimes we almost focus on maybe the poverty is the root cause of the recruitment of these young people to go and join this terror organization. Now, Shaka, history has taught us that some of the people have been arrested or captured who come from the western part of the world. Certainly, we know there's no poverty in the West, but we have some western country citizens coming to join Boko Haram or ISIS or whatever. Now, my question to our guests is that, don't they think that the charlatans among us, those who call themselves the sheikhs in Islam, are the root causes of our problem? Because they go to the Middle East, learn this Quranic lesson. The one they come home, they come and change the whole version of the Quran. They come and be teaching people different thoughts of Islam altogether. Don't they think that it's also a part of our problem? The charlatans who are destroying our beautiful religion. My religion didn't teach me to kill people or harm my neighbor. But you find some charlatans destroying our image. Don't they think it's our problem? Our Saudi authorities and the Gulf countries, don't they think that the time for them to invest, especially in Africa and other poorest countries, to teach the people the real meaning of Islam, than allowing these charlatans to be destroying the Islam? Thank you very much. God bless you, Shaka.
You're most welcome, Tafa. Your reaction?
I'll address the first question. Mm-hmm. He asked about the, you know, how some young people, you know, would be given just 200 naira, mm-hmm. you know, and they would happily go and bomb or kill people. That shows you how much poverty, you know, has taken root in this place.
Mm-hmm.
A person who would kill another person for how much is 200 naira when 200. You translate it to
yeah, it's
like
less
20
than
cents,
$1. Right.
Less than $1. But I also want to kind of go beyond that. There's a system in northern Nigeria called the Almajiri system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is traditionally a system where boys are sent to go and live with an Islamic teacher. Lots of boys, you know, under the control, under the tutelage of this teacher, and he would teach them the Quran, and they'll eventually graduate, just like you graduate in normal schools and all that.
Right.
So this is a traditional way of getting these kids to initiate them into the knowledge of Islam through the teacher, who is usually highly respected and all that. It's a good system, nothing wrong with it, but it's a system that has been proven, you know, to be capable of being exploited, you know, by politicians, by unscrupulous people in the society. And it's said that a lot of the army of Boko Haram came from the ranks of the Al-Majris. If you look at other Islamic countries, Saudi Arabia, they don't have this Al-Majris, you know? So it's not an integral, necessary part of Islam. It's a cultural kind of tradition, but Northern Nigeria.
But someone might remind you that Saudi Arabia brought us Osama bin Laden.
Yes. I just want to kind of focus on the Al-Majri system, because he asked me a question about children, you know, being exploited by these people. So I think there has to be some kind of reformation in terms of how these teachers are allowed to get these children to live with them and to work with them. They have to have greater oversight. The government has to have a say in how these kids are controlled, are educated. So the government has to take, has to provide welfare for these kids, because ultimately they can't take care of themselves. They can't feed themselves.
It has to create opportunities.
Exactly.
What about you as a reporter? How do you, for example, compare Boko Haram with other insurgent groups, for example, in the Niger Delta, like MEND? Or for that matter, you go to East Africa, you have the Lord's Resistance Army of Konye, Joseph Konye, in Uganda.
Yeah, with Boko Haram, you know, just like the professor was saying, when they started in Maiduguri, at first the Al-Majris, some of the Al-Majris were the original members of Boko Haram, those who were attracted to the teachings of Muhammad Yusuf. But don't also forget that later on, most of those who joined Boko Haram were actually thugs, political thugs, those young people who were paid by politicians to intimidate their political opponents. Those were the original members of Boko Haram. And in 2009, after Muhammad Yusuf was killed, somebody was saying in Maiduguri there was something like all the these thugs, they used to call them Ekomog in Maiduguri. All these Ekomog boys.
Everything that could move is gone.
They simply kind of disappeared completely out of Maiduguri. Everybody thought, were these people killed or what happened to them? They disappeared completely. Then in 2010, 2011, they started coming back. And when they came back, at first, they were just killing the policemen and the local ward heads who in 2009 were pointing them to authorities, were saying these were the members of Boko Haram. They started killing those people. And the government did not start getting a handle on this situation until when another set of young people, the civilians, rose up and said, look, we are tired of this. We want to do something. And they formed the civilian JTF.
Talking about being tired, I think Straight Talk Africa is also tired of us. And on that note, thanks to our guests, Ibrahim Ahmed, Managing Editor, Digital Media in VOA's House of Service, and Heron Habira, a Nigerian award-winning author, including The Chibok Girls, The Boko Haram Kidnappings and Islamist Militancy in Nigeria. He's currently a professor of creative writing at George Mason University here in the United States. Thanks to our affiliate stations, along with our viewers and listeners, we thank you for tuning in. For many of our Voice of America radio affiliates, Learning English is coming up next. And tomorrow morning's Daybreak Africa with James Bate. On behalf of the Voice of America, thanks for tuning in to Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Nigeria. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive.